microphone.
All right, then.
Well, you didn't press, you didn't press the button, I was gonna say.
Now, where do we leave off?
Yeah, right.
We were just trying to ask a question.
This is the beginning of the afternoon session, Wednesday, October 21st, 1959.
Hey.
Well, it's on there.
We, let us, get over to...
Sorry, Dave, would you mind talking to...
General, you can hear me all right when I'm, am I difficult for you?
Yeah, but I, you've always sit over here too far, and when I push you over, then you're... Crying.
We've just lost a lot of tape here. If you had to deal with General MacArthur all over again, what would you do about his, repeated defiances of the authority of the president and the civilian control?
Well, the, general in the field, he was a sort of a proconsul for the government of the United States, is necessarily responsible to the president. And when he doesn't do or carry out the program of the president, then he has to be relieved. I was very patient with General MacArthur because I think have relieved him sooner. And I know that Franklin D. Roosevelt should have relieved him as much earlier than the time came for me to have to do it. But I always hate to ruin the reputation of a man who's been in the service of the country for 49 years, and I think that's what his period was. There wasn't anything wrong with the program, and it would have to be done. I probably would do it a little more promptly if I had to do it over.
Now, would you have recalled him to the White House and in view of his rank and his position, and dismissed him or relieved him from the offices of the White House?
I invited him to come to the White House long before this took place. In fact, long before the trip to Wake Island, he said conditions were such in the Far East that it was absolutely necessary for him to stay there. So I met him at Wake Island, which is only a short distance from Japan. When I first invited him to come to the White House, he should have come, and then it wouldn't have been much trouble, I think. In all probability, I would have relieved him then.
What is there about a military personality in times of national stress that gives them such a powerful hold on public opinion and public following?
Well, it's necessary to have able and military men to carry out the program when it's, when you're in an emergency, and we certainly were in an emergency so far as Germany and Japan were concerned at that time. And so I have the same feeling that everybody else has, that a great military man is a necessity. You take any controversy or any war you want to read about, you find the person who's most talked about and who's most necessary is a man who understands how to move military forces so they'll meet the emergency. That's customary and it's natural and you can't help it.
Well, don't they get built up to where they begin to infiltrate the political mechanism of a democracy such as ours and complicate it?
That depends altogether on the man, how he works. You will find that to be the case with most of the great general war leaders, great generals who were war leaders in their time. But sometimes they get a superiority complex. I think Winfield Scott was a shining example of what can happen to a man. So was McClellan. And MacArthur is the one in our time. You find in between that and before that, that the generals usually were men of integrity and men who understood their positions and they had no trouble with them.
Do you consider him one of the great strategists in a military sense?
I considered him a great strategist until he made the march into North Korea without the knowledge that he should have had of the Chinese coming in. That's what caused most of his trouble.
Then you did not encourage his political ambitions at any time, nor did you discourage him?
No, no, I didn't discourage him or I didn't encourage him because all these generals ought to know history as well as I do, and so I didn't try to educate him on that.
And you still feel that a general's capacity for administering a civilian economy such as ours is not necessarily the best?
No, for the simple reason that a general in command of a military force is a dictator. and the President of the United States or any other, the head of any other republic, can't afford to take the attitude of a dictator. He has to get people to agree with what he wants to do and then go ahead and do it. General, most generals can't understand that.
But he did seem to express some of that in his administration of Japan.
He was a good administrator in Japan and did a very good job in restoring Japan. But his business was to be a military leader under the command of the president. He didn't keep in touch with the president as often as he should have. And it took a long time to find out exactly what the trouble was.
Mr. President, here's a very interesting study made by John W. Spanier on the Truman-MacArthur controversy, in which he backs you up completely on the position you took and said that it was historically inevitable and correct. He goes on to say, this need for a field commander more in sympathy with official strategy becomes even more urgent in view of the latitude the United States has traditionally granted its military officers. And he said that one of the essential things is that no government can allow a military officer to challenge its whole foreign policy publicly. Such toleration would undermine its authority to determine the nation's policy, divide the domestic support it needs, and alienate the allies it desires. And just one more quote here. He says, necessity may therefore compel a reexamination of the American tradition of military freedom, lest it excuse us into disaster. In limited warfare, not only military strategy, but on occasions, even military tactics have important political repercussions.
That's a very excellent analysis, and it's as true as it can be. And if you read the history of the country, you read the history of any other country, you'll find that that statement is correct.
And he says, the military, as well as their civilian superiors, will have to recognize that Clausewitz's definition of war as a political tool means that military operations are not only subordinate to political aims, but that there is no such thing as an autonomous sphere in which military operations are conducted in a strictly military manner, unencumbered by outside interference. He went on to say that General Ridgway, the only one who took part in the Korean War, understood war in this broader sense even better than James Van Fleet, Mark Clark, Turner Joy, and MacArthur.
That's just as correct as it can be. Ridgway was one of the ablest men that was mixed up in this thing, and if he'd been there in the first place, in all probability, there would have been no trouble.
Why don't you get that passage where MacArthur refers to the position of a military leader as distinguished from a temporary civilian president or anyone else who is there for just a short time?
Let me intervene right there and make a statement to you about the manner in which the Roman Republic handled its military affairs. The consuls, they had two of them, were elected every year, or every 2 years, mostly every year, and they had control of the military in the field. The main difficulty with that situation was that the two consuls could never make up their minds who was in command, and so they'd take day about at it. And that was the effort of the Roman Republic to maintain civilian control of the military. It didn't work when Hannibal was in Italy, for the very simple reason that the men who were elected to be consuls and generals for the Romans were not as good military maneuvers as was Hannibal. But it was a step in the direction where the civilians should control the military, and we followed through on it by making the President of the United States the Commander-in-Chief of the military forces.
It's very interesting. Well, I will find as you go along.
Because the main point, MacArthur, if you would get the exact quote, MacArthur took the position that the military command have a sworn duty
to the nation,
but not to the President
or not to any temporary officer.
And that's an overriding duty to protect the security of the nation.
He's just as wrong as he can be, because the Constitution of the United States sets up the government of the United States, and the Constitution makes the president the commander-in-chief of the armed forces of the nation, and when he swears to support and defend the Constitution, which he has to do every time he gets a commission, then he has to obey the president when he gives him orders.
Here is the case. MacArthur drew a sharp distinction between his loyalty to the state and those who temporarily held its power. He did this in testimony before the Senate committee. He said, "I find in existence a new and heretofore unknown and dangerous concept, that the members of our armed forces owe primary allegiance or loyalty to those who temporarily exercise the authority of the executive branch of the government, rather than to the country and its constitution, which they are sworn to defend." No proposition could be more dangerous, says MacArthur.
And no proposition could be more dangerous than that viewpoint of the government of the United States. That's what the trouble was. That's exactly what the trouble was. He thought he was a bigger man than the President of the United States. And if his brigadier generals or his colonels had treated him the same way under the same circumstances, what would have happened to them? They'd have been court-martialed. That's what ought to happen to him.
And incidentally, this came out clearly, this defiant position came out clearly only as the hearings before the Senate came out. And the senators suddenly realized that MacArthur had taken a very defiant position on a constitutional question.
Well,
so that you were absolutely
he
right
didn't
on
know
the
what he didn't know what he was talking about when he made that statement. That was a terrible thing for him to do, because that gave away exactly what he was trying to do, is to be a dictator and to tell the president what to do. And the president was there to tell him what to do. That's what the Constitution provides. And he was sworn to support and defend the Constitution.
At any rate, this writer says and sums up that both Clemenceau and Truman proved and showed that war was too important a business to leave to the generals.
That's absolutely true, because as the old German said, it's a political approach to settle things that can't be settled without a fight. That's all there was to it.
In other words, you are even more convinced than ever that you should have relieved MacArthur when you did, and sooner if you had thought about it.
Well, here is a situation she was taking into consideration. I could not become familiar with all the things that had happened previous to the time that I was sworn in as President of the United States. I had to take things on faith and try to carry out the program to win the war, both in the Pacific and the Atlantic, and that's exactly what we did. Had I been familiar with all the things that had taken place between the Commander-in-Chief, Franklin Roosevelt, and the Proconsul MacArthur, the thing would have been settled much sooner, but I had to take things as they came. When the time came and it had to be settled, I settled it. That's all there was to it.
And once you made that decision, you had no special qualms about doing it, even though you knew there would be a considerable public reaction to it?
Not the slightest, because I was familiar with James Madison's trouble with his commanding generals or colonels or officers in the War of 1812. I knew exactly what had happened with James K. Polk and old Fuss and Feathers or Winfield Scott. And I knew exactly what had happened between Lincoln and the five of his field generals, McClellan in particular. And this was just another case of McClellan trying to run the country from the field.
Now, while you're in that mood, could you tell us exactly why you entertained such deep disregard and misgivings for one Richard Nixon?
Well, the thing that causes my disgust with Richard Nixon is his program that he has carried on in California against a certain lady senator who was a good one.
Congresswoman,
Helen K. Hagen Douglas. He was running for senator, I think, at the same time.
That's
he was.
Right.
And then the thing that he did to the congressman whose district he took over, he almost ruined that congressman for no good reason. He was almost as bad as McCarthy in those days in the way he campaigned, and I don't like that kind of business. I never made any personalities out of my campaign.
Incidentally, this book by Spanier quotes Senator Nixon, at the time that you removed General MacArthur, First of all, Senator MacArthur called the president a son of a bitch who must have made his decision while he was drunk on bourbon and Benedictine. McCarthy...
I've never tasted Benedictine, so go ahead.
McCarthy called upon the American people to fight the president's decision lest red waters may lap at all our shores. Unless the public demanded a halt to Operation Atchison, he warned, Asia, the Pacific, and Europe may be lost to communism. Now, Senator Nixon said... Senator Nixon proposed that the Senate censure the president and call upon him to restore General MacArthur to command. MacArthur's dismissal, Nixon stated, was tantamount to rank appeasement of world communism.
Oh, of course, that's the biggest lie that ever was told, and everybody knows that, because MacArthur was finally censured by the Senate itself for just such conversation. And if Nixon had kept it up, he'd have had the same dose of medicine.
Well, and incidentally, isn't Nixon now, isn't he one of the leaders now in trying to appease or play along with the world communism?
It would appear so, but then we can't tell about that until we see what the result is. You see, these political men who take advantage of whatever comes along to help their own political welfare, not thinking so much about the country as they are their own interests, and he's thinking about running for president.
The congressman you had in mind, who was eliminated by Nixon, who ran against him in his districts, was Jerry Voorhees.
Jerry Voorhees, one of the finest men I ever met.
And he accused him publicly of being a degenerate.
That's what he did. And it was absolutely uncalled for and wasn't a word of truth in it at all.
His father was running a boys' school, and he accused this congressman of having his father build his boys' school so that he could have boys.
Well, it's a terrible thing, you know, when character assassination gets into the campaigns for election in a free country. I'll say this for the British. They never, as far as I've been able to find out, attack the character of their opponents. They run on principles and on the reasons for being elected for the welfare and benefit of the country. Now, it's become a fashion since McCarthy was such a rabid rabble-rouser, and since Huey Long was in the same class, to attack the character of people who oppose them and do everything they possibly can to destroy them through the fact that people have a certain system of morals, and you'll never find these birds exposing their own moral background for the welfare of the public. And the trouble with most of the people whom these fellows have hurt has been because they were decent and wouldn't do what their opponents did. That's the only trouble.
And you don't feel that Mr. Nixon has learned and mellowed from time and experience?
Not unless he thought it would help him politically, he wouldn't learn anything.
That means that you don't consider him fit for the presidency.
I never have, never will. I don't consider him fit for the vice presidency. And the only reason he's there is because the powers that be in the Republican Party were afraid of McCarthy.
Of course, Nixon has tried in many months to disavow that he had ever called you a traitor. He keeps on repeating and saying that what he meant was a traitor to the Democratic Party principles rather than a traitor to the nation.
That's a word that shouldn't be used except in its connection with disloyalty to the government of the United States or any other country where a man belongs. And he can't get out of it in any other way. The statement that he made in Texarkana, Arkansas, or Texas, whichever side of the city he was in, was a plain statement that I was a traitor, just as the statement of Jenner up in Wisconsin was that General Marshall was a traitor. And I want to say that the man who could have stopped all that never opened his mouth. He knew better than to take things like that for granted.
Well, let's get over to a pleasanter thing. You had a very nice visit with the President of Mexico.
Yes, I did. I had a very pleasant visit with the President of Mexico.
What is his name?
I can't pronounce it. He's a wonderful man. And
Morales.
No, that's not his name. We'll have to get it for the simple reason that it's pronounced in a little different way from the way it's spelled, and you don't want to mispronounce the name of the president of our sister republic. But While I was, yeah, when he was down at the ranch of our good friend Senator Lyndon Johnson, he expressed a desire to the senator that he would like very much to see me, that he wanted to see me more than any other man in the United States. And of course, I was highly complimented at that. And I went down there to see him and had a very pleasant visit with him. And his purpose in coming to the United States and to Canada was to show his friendliness to the two sister republics in North America. Between the two sister republics in North America and to Canada. And I was very much impressed with him. I think he's a fine man and he has a fine family.
How was his English? Could he?
He couldn't speak English at all, or he didn't attempt to. He had an interpreter with him. He had the same interpreter with him that was with President Alemán when I was in Mexico.
And he did express his interest in you for what reason, sir?
Well, I don't know for what reason, except that he made the statement through the interpreter that I was the most popular American in Mexico. I guess that's the reason, maybe.
Well, why would you be so popular in Mexico?
Well, I had a very pleasant visit in Mexico. President Alemán was in the president's chair down there. And in being shown some of the wonderful things in Mexico City, the pyramids of the Mayas and things of that sort, the Secretary of State in the Mexican government at that time asked me if I would object to putting a wreath on the monument to the Niños Heroes, that's the child heroes who jumped off of Chapultepec and committed suicide rather than let the general, American general, Winfield Scott, capture them. And of course I said I'd do it. I thought it was one of the finest things in the history of the world when those youngsters, for the love of their country, were willing to jump overboard as the ancients used to do rather than to surrender. That's the reason for it. I didn't have anything in view except recognize that heroism isn't confined to one country or one race. You find in every race, in every country, you find things just like this Nina's Heroes thing. That's how it came about. But I wasn't trying to make character with the Mexicans. I was doing something that I believed in.
Do you think we are now fully discharged in our obligations to Mexico?
I don't know. I don't know. The president seemed to be very well satisfied with the relations between us.
What is your feeling about South America, Mr. President? Because the Mexican president has a feeling, as he expressed in Washington, that the South American organization, or that organization of South American states, ought to do more to help South America economically, to do more to bring about mutual assistance and aid.
I'm in complete agreement with that. I'm in complete agreement with that and acted on it when I was president.
You think we're doing enough to further the development of South American neighbors?
Well, I don't know about that. I don't know what's been carried out since I left the White House, but I had made a suggestion to the what is the name of that organization to which you referred? The Association of American States. Organization of American States.
Yes.
On two immense projects. One was to change the overflow of Lake Titicaca on those high 13,000 foot lakes. I think there are three of them, which run to the sea. The overflow runs to the sea through the Madera River. To change the course of that river and send it to the Pacific from that 13,000 foot height, which is perfectly feasible. And as it would go down that 13,000 feet, it would make power enough for Bolivia and Peru and Chile, and then give Bolivia a seaport on the Pacific for the use of that water and that power. And it seemed to make a hit with some of the leaders in both all those countries. And then the development of the two great rivers on the east side of the continent, the Paraguay and the Paraná rivers. There are a couple of falls on those two rivers that have more water over the fall than does Niagara, and they're higher. If they could be developed as they're now developing the Zambezi in Africa, it would be one of the finest things that could happen to South America. And Brazil itself has the greatest undeveloped resources of any country in the world. It could as easily support 340 million as it supports the 40 or 50 million which live there now.
Well, then, those resources that are not yet developed should be developed. Now, how can they be developed in, since they themselves don't possess the means to do it with? Now, who would
well,
do it?
Well, they are working on that situation and have been right straight along. There have been several people in this country who have investments in Brazil, which is creating a development of that sort in South Brazil. There is an area as large as the state of Texas, which has a soil that's 36 feet deep, and it'll grow anything outdoors that'll grow in the temperate zone. Mm-hmm. And when those things are developed, and you must remember that Brazil has the greatest forest resource of any country in the world except Siberia.
Well, yet we see the ironic thing of Brazil sending a mission to Moscow to try to arrange some facilities and some trading and some help from the Russians.
Well, the people who have great things to do will grasp at anything that they think will help. I want you to remember when the British and the French and the Germans poured hundreds of millions of dollars into this country for its development. Had not that been done, it never could have been developed. But as soon as it was developed, it finally turned around so that when they got into trouble, that is the French and the British, that those resources which they had invested in this country gave them the wherewith from this country so they could win. And Brazil may eventually be developed by themselves and by us and by Britain and France and Germany as well as anybody else. And I sincerely hope they don't get tangled up with the Russians, or we get Russia a free government.
As in a look to the future, do you see the possibility of a development, or at least an idea like they have had in Europe, the United States of Europe? Is there the possibility of the United States of North and South America?
No, I don't think that's possible because of the difference in language. You see, in Brazil, it's Portuguese is this, the language of the country, and in the other South American countries, it's Spanish, as it is in Cuba and Puerto Rico and in Mexico. And I don't, it's a very difficult thing for people who have a language barrier to understand exactly what the other fellow means when he talks. And it takes a very careful and skillful interpreter to give the same meaning and emphasis to words in one language to the words in another language. And that's one of the drawbacks. But there's no reason in the world why they can't, why we can't be friendly with them, why we can't help with their development, and why we can't let them have the benefit of the developments that's made in their country. You take that wonderful city down there of Sao Paulo, where it's called the Chicago of South America, and its growth has been phenomenal due to the development of resources back behind that city.
And one final question. You don't expect communism to get an important toehold anywhere in the Americas?
No, I don't. I think as long as the Americas have a moral code based on the Sermon on the Mount and on the 20th chapter of Exodus, there's no chance the communists to get in to do anything about it.
Well, do they have that code?
They have. Yes, they have.
Now, Mr. President, if I can get into another field. You have frequently said that even the private letters, the notes, all the private things that a president does are equally as important as official papers, and all should be preserved as an indication of what the president is and what he stands for. You still
feel
that? I
think that's true. You know, one of the great things about the publication of the papers of George Washington was the fact that he was a very meticulous bookkeeper. He kept track of every transaction that he ever had, no matter how small or how large. And while the actual correspondence and papers of George Washington would cover 10, maybe 12 volumes, the publication of the complete set of Washington's papers took 150 volumes, and that's the reason, because he kept track of everything, and there are some very interesting things in those volumes and papers that most people would have thrown away. The same thing was true of Jefferson. And Jefferson's papers, you know, were scattered because the Congress took it on itself to decide which of Jefferson's papers were official. Now Princeton University is spending about $200,000 or $300,000 trying to get all those papers that the Congress decided were not official together again.
Well, Mr. President, do you then feel also that the letters and the private papers of a former president, as he goes on, also has some importance in the to shed light on him as a man, as a president, and on the period in which he lived.
And on the development of the character which he has to assume as chief executive of this great republic. You see, things happen which sometimes add greatly to the development of the man who's responsible. There are things that happen sometimes that kind of make him deteriorate a little bit. We should know all the ups and downs through which he has to go in order to be a good chief executive.
You meant mostly, though, the period after his office.
I'm talking now also of the period after he has...
Oh, yes, I think that's important, as well as the other period, because it's the most difficult thing for a man to settle down to what's called private life after he's been in a position of that sort. And the former presidents of the United States have been sorely neglected. You take James Madison and James Monroe, and the two or three of the presidents in between them, and the Abraham Lincoln, and several of the presidents since then have been sadly neglected. And most of them, and all of them, had the idea that they should not exploit the fact that they had been in that office. James Monroe and James Madison almost starved to death for that very same reason. That shouldn't happen. That doesn't happen in most countries where they take care of the men who have spent their lives working in public office.